Welcome to the Ethics Experts, where we're elevating ethics and compliance and HR to the strategic level it's supposed to be.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Ethics Experts. If it's your first time joining us, welcome. And if you are a returning subscriber, hello, my best friend in the world. I hope you're having an amazing day. You see what happens when you subscribe to the Ethics Experts? You get that bonus greeting on every single episode. So that is a no-brainer to hit that subscribe button. I am here with the man, Tomel. Tomel, how are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. How about yourself?
Great. Super excited to get you on. You have a really interesting background. You've touched many different interesting aspects of this game, and just super excited to get you on to pick your brain. So why don't we dive in? How did you get into the compliance game? When you were growing up as a young boy, you always wanted to be a compliance officer, I guess.
I don't think it went like that, quite like that. But I actually started off trying to sort of find my footing like anybody else would in their career. And so, I did a little stint in banking. I tried my hand in government. My sort of claim to fame in government was that I worked with Barack Obama, or the then Senator Barack Obama, when he was running for president for the first time in 08. So I tried, a couple of things, and then, that was all in the States, and now I'm located in Dubai. And at that time, in 08, this was during the financial crisis. So America didn't have a lot of jobs, as you can imagine. I had to expand my sort of search for employment. I think I must have applied to like something outrageous, like 400 or 500 jobs at the time. All of like five or just a small handful actually replied to me. I mean, that's how bad things were. And one of them was an opportunity in Dubai. So it was actually to do with analytical work. I ended up leveraging my time in banking doing that. And then that role sort of evolved into an internal controller role. Mm. So it went from, just analyzing the financial aspects of the business to kind of analyzing every aspect of the business. And then I realized I really liked it. It was something that I thought I was good at. I really enjoyed working with people in all departments. After I moved to internal control, I just stayed in compliance for the rest of my career. And almost 15 years later, I'm still here.
Imagine that. Who knew? Who would have thought?
Who knew?
When you were applying to all those jobs, who would have, I'm sure you would have never imagined that you would have spent the next 15 plus years on the other side of the world. What was that?
Oh,
like?
Absolutely.
What was that like applying to that many jobs? I was talking to somebody over the weekend and they were just talking about how broken the job search process is and how frustrating it can be, particularly when the job market is in like total disarray. Where did that tenacity come from in you to keep kind of going and not give up on, in spite of those difficulties that you must have been facing?
Well, hunger, you have to eat food. You have to eat food to survive. So that's probably the biggest motivating factor. At that time, I was freshly out of university. So, you have to, and I graduated from Stanford University. And so unfortunately, you have this premier, you have this premier degree,
right?
And then you're in the unattractive position of being the unfortunate one who has absolutely no job after spending hundreds and thousands of dollars on this premier degree.
Right.
So I was really in quite an unfortunate situation because I graduated with no role. There was at the time, I remember feeling a great deal of shame, personal shame. How could I go to Stanford and then, be unemployed? You just keep at it. And that's what I did. and this role popped up. And I figured, I had no personal connection to the Middle East prior to that. You know, I'm from Chicago, born and raised. So I had never, traveled to Dubai. And this is 08. So this is coming off the back of, the Bush years and the Iraq war and the axis of evil. And, Iran is 80 miles from Dubai. So, I was certainly extremely afraid. I won't kid you, because I packed two suitcases. I hopped on a plane that took, 16 hours to get there. And then I showed up all by myself in the middle of the desert and in God knows where. So this is a long-winded way of saying, no, I would have never imagined myself 14 years later being here. But it's proven to be a really incredibly vibrant place, and particularly in the compliance space as well.
What preconceptions or misconceptions did you have about Dubai prior to, going there and living there? What was something that was really surprising about that part of the world that really kind of took you off guard?
So I don't know if this is a good or bad thing, but, I didn't have any conception of this place because, frankly, I hadn't even heard of it prior to that. And, I studied international relations at Stanford. So, we were learning about remote places like Tatarstan in Russia, really random regions and exploring the cultural and socioeconomic implications of the regimes there. And, so I had thought I had a pretty solid understanding of the, international order, but for whatever reason, I had never heard of Dubai. So I had no perception of what to expect. And so, I just came here open-minded and just kind of landed and said, okay, let's figure this out. And worst case scenario is if I don't like it, I'll head back home. Yeah. And then I never did.
So it seems like you liked it. So, it takes a special person first of all, to make that, to even apply to that job. And then when you get that nibble on the line to say, okay, I'm going to pack up these two suitcases and jump on a 16-hour plane ride to the other side of the world, roll the dice and kind of see what happens. It may have been a mix of both, but where does that sense of adventure come from in you? I mean, that's a massive adventure that you embarked on. Was it from, was it just the fact that you were like, hey, I don't have anything else, I need to kind of go and do something? Or was it, it's just a special type of person to be willing to kind of, make that type of a leap?
Well, thanks for saying that. I'm not sure I saw myself that way, right? I just think, my family is pretty international. I would say we traveled when I was a young kid, so I had been exposed to the world, throughout my childhood. And I myself am, multiracial and had a sort of multiracial, multinational household. So I would I was probably primed, for those things not to seem alarming in any sense. But granted, it was a pretty big roll of the dice, I will admit, and I don't know, something just compelled me, I would say. I was just compelled. I felt that this was very much the right opportunity for me. And I was really interested just to see what it would be like. And again, I always thought to myself, the worst case scenario is I could just go back home if I didn't like it. So at the end of the day, even the worst case scenario wasn't too bad.
Yeah. What you just said there is kind of a commonality I find among people who are willing to roll the dice or are willing to take the leap. A lot of people who aren't willing to take that leap, they think it's really like such a long way down. And what I find common among folks who do take the leap is they're like, well, it's not really that far of a way down. Worst case, boom. The worst case is a safety net, or the worst case is I'm not leaping off the edge of a building. I'm actually just stepping off of a curb, and that allows for a lot more. It allows you to try a lot more things, which I love that kind of spirit. I think it's really inspiring. So you came in, you started doing kind of financial analysis, then you moved to this control position in the firm, and you said that, man, I really liked it. And I think you said that it was really cool because you were analyzing all aspects of the firm. I know that you had this background in banking that you were able to borrow from, but what was it about that move into control that really resonated with you at such a deep level to the point where you're like, I feel like I might have kind of found my home in a, from a career perspective?
You're really good at asking very pointed questions. I mean, in getting at the heart of the matter, that's a great question. I would say, you know, so the firm I stepped into was a French oil and gas firm called Total. And it was kind of being in the right place at the right time. So they were undergoing this exponential growth at that time where, you know, that office that oversaw their Middle East, North and Eastern Africa and CIS operations was kind of, you know, sort of a sleepy run-of-the-mill office. And then at that time, it just all of a sudden experienced this huge exponential growth where they were receiving tons of money there. And what they quickly found out is that the infrastructure was not there in that office. And what I mean by infrastructure, I mean governance, right? So where's the money going? And, you know, what are the controls they have in place? So suddenly, you know, the Paris was frankly very concerned about, wow, that's a lot of cash coming into this affiliate. You know, what kind of controls do we have in place to make sure that the right decisions are being made and that this money is managed well? And so I was kind of put into, you know, even though it was an internal control position, what I was doing was top of mind.
Right.
So I loved that. I think, you know, being a young fellow at that time, I was 22, having the ability and the opportunity to work on something that was so instrumental and, you know, be catapulted kind of on this stage where, you know, I'm working with very senior people, I'm working on very consequential things. I was not that analyst in a bank out of, you know, 20,000 analysts, you know. I was one who was leading key strategic projects for that affiliate. And I think it was that fact, that opportunity to kind of prove myself,
right,
when the stakes were so high, that kind of was the thrill for me. And so I think it was, you know, it was principally that, and also the scale of the challenge. You know, I love challenges. I thrive on challenges. You know, as you can see, I even roll, you know, the roll of the dice. I am a risk taker, but I would say calculated risk taker. You know, I'm definitely not a gambler in any kind of the sense where I'll just throw the die and hope for the odds to go in my favor. That's definitely not my cup of tea. But if I've done the analysis and, you know, it makes sense, I will take the risk. And so, it was that challenge. It was that challenge, the opportunity to tackle this enormous project. And then I would say the last piece of this was, I was very fortunate to have a management that actually gave me that opportunity, because it's very rare, right?
Yeah.
That any company of any stature will give a, you know, little brat, a 23-year-old brat, you know, any opportunity to do anything of consequence other than, you know, some Excel,
yeah,
worksheets, you know.
Staple these papers. Punch some holes in these papers.
Right. Exactly. Go file these and, you know, sweep up yeah, the front, exactly, entrance or something. So they were super incredible management that said, okay, well, here's a guy who looks pretty switched on. Let's give him a chance. And so they supported me, right? They put me in trainings. They encouraged me. They gave me the platform. They believed in me. And so I was just very, very, very fortunate. And so I'm still in touch with many of those management from that period, because it's, of course, something I'll never forget. And yeah, it was a great time.
So this is going to be kind of a weird question, but, you know, as I'm kind of reflecting on that story, you just told, you know, you kind of framed it out as being at the right place at the right time. And that was obviously a piece of the puzzle, right company, right kind of support system, but also kind of the right experience. As that whole thing kind of set your career on a trajectory, how much of like who you've become was driven by like the actual tacit experience that you had versus like you just believing in yourself and recognizing like, okay, wow, I can do this? Because I remember when I was like, you know, 23, you know, I mean, I probably still have imposter syndrome like daily, you know what I'm saying? But like you know, this pitch kind of came across the plate and you presumably kind of crushed it. Granted, you had the batting coaches and all that other stuff, but those seeds of confidence that get laid as a foundation in our careers end up really, I think, influencing the arc of our career. So as you kind of deconstruct where you're at now, how would you attribute, you know, where you're at now to kind of those two pieces, the actual experience and like just the confidence or the confirmation that like you could do it in this complex environment?
Yeah. Another great question. I see why you do this. Yeah, this is great. I think nothing is possible for anybody if they don't believe in themselves, right? I think the departure point is self-belief. You have to, you know, even if the faith in yourself is the size of a mustard seed, you know, you have to have it. Mm-hmm. Somewhere in yourself, you have to believe that you can do it. And then it's trial and error after that, right? You never know if you're going to make it. No one knows, right? Even if you're however confident. And so, of course, you know, you're bound to experience imposter syndrome. You're bound to experience, you know, lack of self-confidence in doing things you've never done before or experienced before. Especially, you know, for me, given that I had never lived outside of America, I was in a completely foreign environment. I'm working with nationalities and people that have nothing to do with anything I grew up with.
Right.
Or had any sort of familiarity with. But what I saw was that I had to prove myself to myself. Mm. So I was never out to prove myself to other people. And I never lived in a way where I thought, gosh, you know, I better show that I'm X, Y, or Z, right? For someone else. Now, I always thought about that for myself. And I said, I always, you know, in my mind, I said, if you believe that you can do this, then you have to prove to yourself that you can do this, right? So it's one thing to come with vibrato and confidence and say, yes, I can, you know, do whatever. It's another thing to deliver, right? And at the end of the day, I think, you know, real imposters always get caught out at some point, yeah, right? The circumstances will arise where the person will be shown for who they are.
Right.
And, you know, so what's the alternative? The alternative is you're then the actual, you know, you do the real deal, that you are who you say you are and that you can do what you say you can do. And, you know, it's kind of like iron being forged in fire. You know, the only way for the iron to become stronger is to be continually inserted in fire, right? And then hammered out. And so that's what I really focused on. I always focused on prove to, you know, I said to myself, Tamel, prove to yourself that you can do this. And once you can prove to yourself that you can do this, then everything else will take care of itself. And that was kind of my modus operandi.
Have you always been that way? So it's kind of an interesting distinction that you made, that you are out to prove to yourself. And I think, to your point, a lot of people are sort of more externally focused and they're more concerned about how they're perceived outwardly, and hey, can I prove it to my coach or prove it to my boss or prove it to my dad or whatever. I find that people who have that sort of inward focus of I just need to prove this to myself and then the chips will fall where they may, it ends up kind of conveying a more sort of substantial or substantive, if that's the right word, confidence. It's that's not as like subject to like the animal spirits or just like the blowing, you know, a blade of grass in the wind. Have you always been kind of wired that way? And if not, when did that light bulb turn on to say, you know, I need to stop worrying about what these people think and really just kind of prove it to myself? It feels like a stronger frame, you know?
Well, now you're getting at more existential issues. So, you know, yes, I've been, you know, inclined that way because of my spiritual sort of exposure and my spiritual sort of consciousness. So, you know, I am, you know, I'm a Buddhist. So that kind of thinking in introspection is intrinsic in Buddhist philosophy.
Interesting.
But at the same time, I'm a human being, so I'm subject to the same, forces that everybody else is. And, you know, the greatest introspection doesn't mean that you don't have the same doubts and all those things that happen to every other person. What I would say is that, it's not an all or nothing, right? It's not you're entirely focused just on yourself and you care less what happens, you know, to the world. You don't live in a vacuum. You're not in a, you know, in a silo. So of course you care about proving yourself. Of course you understand that you have a reputation and that reputation matters and that you're conscious of how you are perceived and things of that nature. But if you are driven by that, or if that becomes your sole focus or even more than 50% of your focus, then it becomes what you say what you've alluded to in your example, you become a blade of grass in the wind where you're blown by everything because you cannot control people's perception of you. You can't control anything. Your manager can change, any number of circumstances can change, and then what becomes of you in those situations. So the only thing you can control is yourself and how you view yourself. And so becoming a master of yourself is the only way to assure your own success because everything else is pure, you know, quote unquote coincidence. Yeah, or chance.
Yeah, and to your point, it's something that you can't even affect regardless of your level of agency. To your point, your manager changes.
Absolutely.
You know, I've spent all this effort and burned all these calories trying to impress this manager. I still haven't proven anything to myself. That manager changes and I'm back where I started.
Right.
I love that. Can you say that again? The main thing is to become a master of yourself. It was something like that.
Yeah, I can't recall exactly what
I said,
but
genius.
I
have to rewind it. And put it into a clip.
Okay.
All right. Anyways,
sure.
So you're this young guy. You're thrust into this really interesting opportunity. You had this really kind of unique support from management to try to help put some controls in place around this office that was getting a bunch more, you know, revenue, a bunch more potential risk. How did your career sort of progress from there, and what sort of arrows were you able to put into your quiver from that opportunity or from that experience that you carried forward into your latter experiences?
Yeah, so you know, once I had made the determination that kind of, you know, what I was good at aligned at what I was doing, mm-hmm. right? So I was very fortunate that I sort of had the skill set that aligned with the skill set requirement of this role, which is internal control. That, you know, I climbed up the ladder like everybody and got promoted to, you know, bigger roles and you know, I ultimately left that company being the head of corporate governance. And at that time, I had internal audit reporting to me. I had enterprise risk management reporting to me. Compliance, corporate governance. So I had acquired a sort of very broad remit of responsibilities, and I was able to be at the forefront of, you know, those things, you know, at a leadership level, for, you know, Total's, you know, very profitable and quite large, you know, affiliate in the region. So that gave me a great deal of confidence that, you know, I could pull this off in other places. Yeah. And so I said, you know, this is a good thing. And I wanted to continue. And I've always also been, you know, interested in government. So I decided that if I wasn't going to go back into government in the States, I would at least try to do government here. So that was the reasoning behind my subsequent move to Emirates National Oil Company, which is a state-owned enterprise. And, you know, that in of itself is sort of a long story about Bill Finger's journey with the DPA. I was the regional compliance manager for MENOT, and I was the first one ever in the company's 50-year history to be deployed there in the region. And of course, I was there under the monitorship, you know, in the DPA, in the throes of it, at the height of its DPA. And it actually was an EDPA, it was an extended DPA. So I joined during the extension of the DPA because Bill Finger was not able to get out of the initial 3-year DPA.
So I've heard that a DPA is a, you know, it's a, you just learn so much in it. You know, it's a critical, I mean, if you can come out the other end of it, I guess, it can really teach you a lot. Did you find that to be the case with your own career and your own experience?
Yeah, it kind of goes back to what we were saying earlier. You know, it was the ultimate test of whether you know what you're doing, right? So, you know, I consciously obviously chose that position because here was another example of sort of me saying, you know, if you believe, Tamel, if you believe in yourself, then you should be able to do this. And, you know, it was a very scary thing. You know, I am not a lawyer, but, you know, all of my counterparts were lawyers, right? And being a DPA, that's a very litigious, you know, situation. It's all about the legality of everything. Right. So you've got external counsel, the monitor's got external counsel, the monitor himself is a lawyer, the DOJ is staffed with lawyers. You know, it's a very legal issue. And then being the only non-lawyer in the room over and over and over again, you know, you're really put to the test where some of the things you said about imposter syndrome can definitely arise. Yeah. But ultimately, what I said to myself was, if I can navigate this and do it well, then I really believe in myself now.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I had to bust my tail. It just worked. I was working like a dog in those 2 years. But I think ultimately we passed the test because we were certified in the end, which we didn't always think would happen. So that was a good end to the story.
Yeah. You don't want those DPAs to turn into EDPAs and EEDPAs and on and on. So that's, but you know, I mean, in my career, it's, there have been times like that as well, where it's like, man, you got to buckle down and you really have to, you know, you're working a lot because you're trying to keep up with these smart people around you and you want to prove yourself and show that you can hang and all that kind of stuff. And while at the time it's hard to catch your breath and it's hard to, you know, it's a tough time to go through working 80 hours a week or whatever it is, when you look back, I mean, at some level, you know, you get three years of experience in 2 years, or you get 4 years of experience in a couple of years, which is kind of phenomenal.
Exactly.
It helps you really accelerate forward. And again, helps to really kind of confirm and, you know, lay another layer on that foundation of, you know what, I might not be the batting champion, but I can hit a major league fastball and I can hang here with these guys. And, you know, my experience is valid and I can bring something to the table. What was your biggest surprise about the DPA? You know, a lot of our listeners have heard of these things. Some of them have lived through them, but many of them have not. What was a big surprise about living through that process and kind of navigating out of it?
So, you know, the amount of scrutiny and attention to detail is at a whole different scale, right? Because what you're doing becomes part of a record which supports either the release of the DPA or the continuation of the DPA, right? So everything you're doing is on record, and especially as an American, even when you're giving testimony in, you know, with monitor interviews, that testimony, you know, you can be perjured if you lie, yeah, or misrepresent, right? So it's a very, very serious situation, and you know, it's nothing to play with. So I always encourage compliance professionals who are serious about, you know, a career in compliance, that a DPA is an absolute must, because, you know, that's like the boxer finally stepping into the boxing ring. You can punch a bag and spar all you want, but until you're in that ring with the opponent getting punched in the face, yeah, and, you know, trying to knock the other guy out, you're just never going to be a real boxer. So, you know, it is the boxing championship of the compliance world. And if you want to prove your chaps, then you have to pass through that kind of situation for all of the things that I mentioned. And that was what was most surprising to me, is when, you know, you'd be in a room talking about your compliance program, and, you know, there are 25 people in the room and 24 of them are lawyers, and they're all recording what you did, what you said you did, at what time, and then they want evidence that you did what you said you did. And, you know, this includes, you know, then you multiply that by this country, that country, this issue, that issue, and then you're talking about many, many issues that you have to all keep in your head. You have to all be clear, you know, extremely clear about what did and did not transpire, who did and did not do certain things. And, you know, the last thing you want to do is lose your credibility, yeah, in an environment like that as a compliance professional, because if you misrepresent or, you know, or just, you know, lie, or, you know, any other erroneous thing, then, you know, there are serious, serious consequences for you.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of a, I don't know. It's like a totally high pressure. You can't get out over your skis. You can't be shooting from the hip. You have to be very measured in your words, I imagine. You have to be very dialed in on what you're talking about and stuff like that. Did you see anybody kind of crack underneath that pressure?
No comment.
I'm assuming that that's a yes. Okay.
I believe
there's
the fifth.
An offline story we can hear about that, but man, I'm just picturing it. I mean, what a high stakes situation, you know? That analogy, yeah, about it being a fight is great. And yeah, at some level, you know, we're just in the dojo and we're practicing these moves, but until you take it to the street, you don't know if the moves really work or not. And DPA lets exactly you test if those moves work. So you did that for a couple of years. You got about 10 years of experience in two, and then you moved on to where?
So now I'm at the group head of compliance, of ethics and compliance for Careem, which is a super app, which basically is a fancy term that we use to say that you can do many, many things. You can avail many services in one single app. And we are a wholly owned subsidiary of the Uber Group. So Uber acquired Careem for $3.1 billion in January of 2020. And yeah, that was a real exciting time because I was brought on board right before that acquisition to oversee the compliance related to that acquisition. And then to subsequently, you know, build the compliance program and then manage it.
So were you working with the acquirer's lawyers to do, like, were they doing a bunch of compliance diligence prior to the acquisition? And what was that whole process like? I imagine you had to get up to speed very quickly if you were brought in right before the transaction.
Yeah, so I didn't come in at that phase. I came in once the asset purchase agreement, the APA, was actually signed.
Oh, cool.
So... So what happened
was done already.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. So what I did and what I was focused on was something very cool is, you know, whenever there's a transaction of that scale, you're talking about billions of dollars, you know, an APA sets forth, certain, compliance commitments that, the acquiree company has to undertake. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the acquiring company, so Uber in this case, wants to ensure that whatever they're purchasing remains what they thought they were purchasing when the deal closes, you know, 7 or 8 months later, right? They don't want to buy one thing and then 8 months later it ends up being, you know, something completely different because of whatever, you know, transpired. And then at the same time, they also want to ensure that the risks that a non-US company, you know, sort of has innately due to its sort of intrinsic operations, do not present any existential legal issues for them once they are one entity. So it's twofold. It's one, ensuring that, you know, the company is maintaining certain postures so that its evaluation stays consistent with the initial evaluation. And then the secondary component is bringing the company up to the regulatory standard of a U.S., you know, U.S. Corporation, which definitely is more stringent than any foreign, you know, company.
Yeah, so there was some heavy lifting, presumably, to make that, to you know, raise that up to that level. What were some of your, the biggest challenges or the biggest learnings or the things that are really kind of imprinted on your mind from a toolbox perspective, from a learnings perspective, after having gone through that process?
Well, I would just say, you know, it's always good to have great counsel. It's always good to have lawyers in the room.
Yeah.
You know, lawyers can be your friends too. So, you know, making sure that you have proper counsel to advise on certain things, because when you're dealing with things of that scale, you know, you only have two eyes, right? And a limited amount of time.
Yeah.
You have to have really competent switched on people on your side, looking at things triple, double, quadruple, looking at stuff to make sure you're not screwing anything up.
That's good. That's always good advice. Get a good lawyer. I'd like to get kind of tactical now. You know, you're somebody who has a really interesting experience, as we just kind of spent some time talking about. When you think over your career, who has been your kind of greatest mentor, and what were the learnings that you took from them that you still carry forward today, that you still share with other folks?
Wow. So I think probably my former manager. She was incredibly impressive, brilliant, very pragmatic. This was during the time of the DPA. Yeah. And so, you know, when you're dealing with such a high stakes, high pressure, contentious environment, you know, like you said, you can easily crack, right?
Totally.
So she was not one that did. And she was, you know, one tough cookie. And I think she really taught me how to manage extremely high pressure, high stakes situation, but to laugh in those situations, and to enjoy what you can while you're in that situation. So to not let it get to you, to where it breaks your spirit or breaks your, you know, your confidence or anything, even if you make mistakes, even if whatever happens, that kind of perseverance on her part. And then just the pure technical skill that she had, she taught me incredibly a lot about the technical side of compliance, which was really fantastic.
That's an interesting lesson that you just alluded to there. Because so many times when people answer that question, they talk about something very sort of tactical or some kind of a framework that was really embedded in them, in their minds or something. And you just kind of talked about being able to find the beauty in the chaos, or being able to find, you know, to keep your feet on the ground or on the ocean, or I'm sorry, keep your feet on the ship deck as, you know, as the ocean undulates below you. It might be the most critical skill, because otherwise you can get chewed up and spit out by these complex processes and these high pressure situations that we find ourselves in from time to time. What do you think is, So the thing that's kind of top of mind here that everybody's talking about, we just went to this conference and it was on the tips of everyone's tongue. It was almost in every single breakout sessions title is this whole ESG thing. What are your kind of general thoughts about it? It's a definite buzzword over here. How do you guys look at it and think about it, and where do you feel like this whole thing is going?
So I don't, you know, I guess, I would say that it's still, this whole concept is still being baked in the oven.
Yeah.
And it needs, you know, it's almost, you know, it's where the cake is, like on the outside it's done, but on the inside it's still gooey.
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
that's exactly right.
So I think that's where it's at, you know, and I think it needs to be thought through more, because we've ran into a lot of these buzzwords over the years. Yeah. You know, there was sustainability. At one point, everything was about sustainability. Is it sustainable? Is it sustainable? You know, and that was the big buzzword. And then, you know, there's been just so many, you know, sort of buzzwords over the time that we have to see what makes sense and what doesn't. But what I will say about it is that I absolutely love the idea of broadening accountability and stakeholder acknowledgement. So, yeah. You know, understanding that there are various stakeholders beyond sort of this legal framework, which is what compliance normally gets lodged into. Understanding there are various components that contribute to, you know, ethics, accountability, integrity, and also just doing the right thing by communities, by the various stakeholders. I think that kind of thinking, broadening the thinking has been hugely helpful. Who should be behind that?
Yeah.
Who should spearhead that? You know, who's best placed to do that? I think all those things still need to be thought through and figured out. By and large, I agree with it, but I think it needs to be teased out still.
Yeah, it's an interesting debate actually going on, and it seems to be kind of falling in, you know, kind of two different sides. One says, you know, this should not be compliances to own. The other side says this is a great opportunity for compliance to elevate to this more sort of strategic position, more power in the organization. You know, there's so many ESG things, so to speak, that are already in the mix. We just need to sort of draw a circle around those things to kind of get started. Where do you think it's going to shake out? Do you think a new group will emerge that might subsume compliance, or do you think it might end up getting tucked up underneath compliance, or do you think it's too early to tell?
You know, I'm not a fortune teller, so I don't really know where it's going to go. But I guess I'll give my two cents on, you know, on what I think about in general. I am absolutely for leveraging compliance's hierarchical and strategic authority within a company to expand into other areas that benefit more stakeholders. So I understand traditionalists' view about, you know, compliance being second line of defense. It needs to stick there. It's this purely legal matter. But simply building a department on enforcement avoidance, I think, limits the capacity and capability of the individuals within compliance. And we have such a unique purview, you know, yeah, within companies. And in terms of the governance, we already have that visibility and authority, right, and independence, which are perfect, you know, platforms to further entrench these more principled, you know, policies and projects. So I think it just needs to be done in a way that is not counterproductive, or that takes away from compliance's traditional remit. So what that constellation looks like, I think, is still baking in the oven. But I certainly see some I see the light in expanding compliance with additional remit and tools that further support the company's stated position in its code of conduct, right? Because compliance ultimately even owns the code of conduct. And so if you're stating all these big grandiose values, but you don't actually have programming to support, then, you know, it just becomes sort of smoke and mirrors. So, you know, compliance can step in many of those cases to fill in those gaps, but to what extent, how, who, what, I think still is out.
Yeah. And it may end up kind of being a little bit different for each company, and, you know, who knows where it'll be in kind of 5 or 10 years. But on that note, if you, I know you're not a fortune teller, but if you moonlit as one, or if you could figure, you know, if you have some tea leaves you could look at, it's 10 years down the road from now, it's 2031. How do you think ethics and compliance has sort of changed? How do you think our role within our organizations have changed? And how do you think our impact has sort of shifted from what it is now?
So I am writing a book, and I do advocate in this book for compliance's role to be expanded.
Amazing.
For the reasons that I've kind of cited already.
Yeah.
So my position, I don't know whether it'll happen or not, but my position is at least is that there is more value within the compliance professionals to extract than is currently being extracted. And I think that the needs of society and communities are as such that compliance really could be a key department to help promote some positive change, not only within compliance, you know, within the company itself, but even the communities in which the companies impact. So I'm very much in favor of compliance taking on expanded responsibilities that enable it to really give credence and depth to all the things a company attests to in its code of conduct. And I think the governance structure is set up to support that with the right visibility, with the right hierarchical authority and access to all of the necessary powers, be it the CEO, executive committee, or even the board of directors. So I think there's a lot of sense in further empowering compliance professionals with additional tools.
Yeah, it feels like we're at a really exciting time. Maybe this industry has always been really exciting. It feels though as if it's more exciting than it's been in the last few years. And the opportunity for us to expand our impact, for us to expand our reach, it feels like it's right. It's right within our grasp. Once your book is done, I'd love to have you back on to dive deep on that. That sounds super exciting. So I want to be conscious of time. I'd like, as we wrap up, if you could go back to the young Tomel, go back in time, what advice would you give him?
Oh, goodness. What advice would I give the young Tomel? Never give up.
Love it. Good. Keep going. Keep one foot in front of the other. So
that's right.
Tomel, where can people find you? You know, this has been a great conversation. I really was excited to get you on. This surpassed my,
thank you so much for having me on.
Even high expectations that I implicitly put on you. Where can people find you? Where can they learn more about you and connect with you?
LinkedIn is the best. I have my profile there. I don't have any sort of personal websites or anything of that nature, but LinkedIn is the best.
All right. Well, thanks so much for joining us on the Ethics Experts. Until next time. All right, that was a good one.